I'm speaking with Cedar Mathers Wynn.
Hi there.
I'm looking forward to a very interesting conversation across a variety of topics, but one of the things he's doing is teaching a course at the Montana Outdoor Science School, and that's a course that allows people to be certified as a quote, Montana Master Naturalist.
That's right.
Yeah. What does that entail? Like, what does certification even mean? Who certifies? And are there specific requirements for that? Or as an instructor, do you get to say, yes, you are certified, no, you are not? Or how does that work?
Yeah, so the certification, there's like a nationwide Master Naturalist program. Each state kind of has its own rules and things. For Montana, there are some requirements, like you have to keep a field journal during the whole course of the class. You have to, you know, commit a certain amount of number of hours, and you have to be, you know, spending a good amount of time on different naturalist skills. So things like simple stuff like using binoculars and hand lenses, but also a little bit more advanced techniques like dichotomous keys and, you know, learning how to use field guides. So like basics of biology.
What's a dichotomous key?
Dichotomous key, right. So that's if you're trying to figure out, like, you know, what is this pine cone I have in my hand, or what is this flower that I just found in the woods? For lots of different organisms, specifically like plants and fungi, but sometimes mammals and other things as well, you can, for anything you can hold in your hand, basically, and it's not going to die. They'll have these keys, so these books with like a set of instructions for you to, like, quote unquote, key out the specimen that you're looking at, so you can identify it to species or whatever level you want to get to. And it's dichotomous because it's broken up into like a series of steps. Sometimes there's like over 100 steps to get to a species from, like, you know, not knowing anything about what this organism is. But each step will give you two options, and you pick one of the two options, and that'll lead you to the next step that'll eventually get you to.
Oh, like it's green or not green, you know?
Exactly, yeah.
Taller than 3 feet or shorter,
right,
sort of thing.
Or like auditory bulla is 3 centimeters versus like 3 millimeters or something like that. Yeah, those kinds of things, something you can look at. And
I see. So identification skills.
Yeah, identification skills beyond just like, you know, visual ID, but like actually going through something and, you know, in your hand keying it out is like a process. So it's a little different than, you know, knowing what bird that is that just sang.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So why is that identification important? Is that just a personal satisfaction you get from knowing I saw X?
Mm-hmm.
Or do you only need that if you're doing research and, you know, compiling lists of, you know, observed species in some area?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So, I mean, if you were doing research, you definitely would want to know what species you're looking at. But I think there's a lot of different answers to that question. So I'll answer, like, what I personally think is important about being able to identify stuff to species or to whatever, you know, higher level. I found that, so the first, like, group of organisms that I got really into was birds. And, you know, before I really thought about what birds I was seeing on a regular basis, I would have, if you'd asked me, I probably would have said, like, yeah, maybe I see, like, 2 or 3 different kinds of birds in a day, like, I don't know, crows and gulls and whatever, small stuff. But once I actually started learning to identify all these different species, I realized that there were tons of birds around. This was in California at the time, and there's like always, you know, year round in California, there's tons of birds, even in winter. Like, but yeah, just realizing the immense diversity that there was out there. I think even if it's just like a number, that really expanded my thinking about what was around and what I had been ignoring for so long. So that's one thing. I think identification just opens up a world of diversity that you don't really get otherwise. And I think also the process of going through, especially with these more complicated identification, like, maneuvers, like using a dichotomous key or a field guide, they really force you to look more carefully and closely at the organism that you're trying to identify. So like with some of these, you know, if you find a mammal skull, learning to identify it to species can be really difficult, especially if you don't kind of have the tools like this course is intended to teach. But once you go through that whole process, you really learn a whole lot about that specimen that you're looking at. And same with anything else, like with identifying a bird, you know, you have to learn a lot about that organism in order to be able to identify it. So I think there's a lot to it other than just like, oh, I can do that. Like, there is a satisfaction, like you said, but I think it goes deeper than just putting a name to an animal.
Well, that probably helps you at least, you know, if you are keeping a journal to remember what you've seen, if you're able to put a name, at least a private name to it,
right.
It's a lot easier if there's if the names are already known and you can just learn them. Do you have any private names or any maybe private favorite species that you consider, I don't know, your avatars or
I don't know if I have
especially connected to
definitely. All right, so private names, the first, before I knew what this bird was, this was like my favorite bird. I would just hear it singing in the woods, and they're all over the place. I learned later it was called the hermit thrush, and they have this really fantastic song. I always found them really hard to find before I like really got, you know, dug into birds. Mm-hmm. Cause they'll sing from like, you know, not especially prominent locations. They're usually close to the ground. They're this dull brown bird. They blend in really well, but they have this song that's amazing. It sounds, I've heard it described as being like a flautist at the bottom of a well.
Hmm.
And to me, like, I always heard it at a distance, and in my head I called it the bird that sings its own echo, because it really sounds like that. And I think probably what's going on there is that birds have this syrinx where they have two different vocal channels, so they can produce two notes at once. And it sounds, you know, I don't know this for sure, but now, like, with my trained ear, knowing a little bit more about the biology, I think it actually is singing its own echo. Like, not necessarily to sound like an echo, but it doubles its voice in this way that's like copying a little bit delayed, so it really does sound like an echo.
So it's not what you would call harmony in like a Western music sense.
No, yeah, very few birds conform to Western musical convention, which is one of the coolest things about bird song, I think. Especially with a music background. But yeah, that's one bird or one animal that I have a I don't know, a special name for, and like I've always really liked it a lot.
Well, on a side note, I noticed you received a bachelor's degree in music, in fact.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a connection for you? Is it because birds are the, I guess, most musical?
Sure.
Maybe sounds in nature, but at least certainly it seems like they would be the most musical animals.
Yeah, as long as you're not underwater.
Yeah, okay.
Whales are pretty cool.
Good point, especially coming from California.
True, yeah. Not that I've ever actually heard a whale song in person, but yeah, I mean, that was definitely that was a huge part of me getting into, I guess, naturalizing in general, was realizing how much you could learn from just listening to natural sound, I guess. And a lot of that was birds. That was huge. Yeah. I mean, I was doing my music degree, like kind of focusing in ethnomusicology. So I was already kind of thinking about like, what does sound mean and what information is contained in sound for different people, and in different cultures and stuff like that. But thinking a little bit beyond that to like different species was a really, you know, enticing concept for me. So yeah, it was absolutely. And then there's like the aesthetic appeal as well, but that's always kind of been secondary for me. I think a lot of musicians focus more on the aesthetic, but for me, the kind of information and like communication element of animal sound has been like the most gripping.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about some of the actual activities you might do, not only things you might do for this course, if someone were taking the course, for becoming a naturalist, but also things that maybe you would also recommend to someone not taking the course, but things people can do to gain the kinds of experiences that they would have the chance for if they did take the course.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think keeping a nature journal, like I mentioned a second ago, is a really useful activity. I mean, it's in so many ways, but in terms of like gaining naturalist knowledge, that's really what being a naturalist is all about, is kind of being inquisitive. And I don't know, I had an English teacher in high school who said, notice what you notice. And he was talking about literature, but I think that applies equally well to being a naturalist, or, you know, being an observant participant in the outdoors rather than just jogging through, you know, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I think keeping a nature journal is great because it gives you a place to record your observations, and kind of an opportunity, or even like a little bit of an impetus, maybe forces you a little bit to make deeper observations and to actually spend time with them and, you know, kind of develop questions. What does this mean? Why is this happening? Why do I keep seeing like this type of footprint near this type of habitat and not, you know, other places like that, those kinds of things. So I think that's one really useful one. And then the other thing is just going outside, right? I think that the more time you spend outside, at least for me personally, the more time I spend outside, like, the better a person I am. If you go out with an inquisitive mind and slow down, I think slowing down is crucial And that's part of the reason nature journaling is so great. But yeah, slow down, pay attention, notice what you notice. And yeah, just try to use like all your senses to understand where you are and what's happening.
Is there any particular structure you use or recommend for a nature journal, or do you just kind of try to be noticing and note down things as quickly as you can? Or do you try to think, oh, I should attend to this and that? Or do you have any procedure that you follow?
Sure. Well, so with the course, it'll be a little bit more guided, so not as free form as maybe just like someone with their journal. But yeah, I would say definitely focus on stuff. So like, you know, I mean, I would always do it by taking my journal out to some place, sitting down, and I always really like to go to the same place every time, because then you really get a connection to that place. You really learn what's going on there. And I think that personal connection is one of the biggest parts about being, you know, a naturalist and like an active, like I said, an active participant in the outdoors. So I think going to the same place gives you a certain amount of focus, but then also like just spending as much time as you feel like you need to fully explore a topic. So like, I remember one nature journal entry from a while ago was like looking at the bark on this tree, and the whole, I think I spent 2 hours looking at stuff on the bark of this Douglas fir tree. This was near Missoula. And, you know, there was like so many different kinds of lichen, and I kept finding all these little, I think they were pseudoscorpions and different mites, just like all this stuff hanging out in the bark of the tree. Realizing that, like so much, you know, diversity, like this full ecosystem in this very small microhabitat, was really fascinating. And yeah, that's totally like a good case study for why it's important to slow down and focus in and just like take your time observing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
So I'd say focus is a big one. Yeah.
Another thing I noticed in your syllabus is that you want to develop the skills to engage as environmentally conscious citizens.
Sure.
So what are those skills? What are you thinking of there? I mean, beyond just learning about nature and developing observational capabilities and so on, but to participate as an environmentally conscious citizen.
Right.
What should we be learning about?
Well, so we'll be spending some time in this class talking about different environmental issues and kind of trying to educate ourselves on, you know, all the different sides of those issues. So there's lots of different stakeholders, people who have an opinion and like, you know, information and are in some way connected to this issue. And I think it's really easy for people to kind of get stuck on their personal opinion about something. And that's certainly true for myself as well. But one thing about being an environmentally conscious citizen, I think, is understanding all the different perspectives that people have on a certain issue and why they think that way. And I think trying to be open-minded about what kinds of solutions are actually practical that take into account everybody's needs.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose. So yeah, so I think that's a big part of it, is understanding different perspectives on a lot of these like very you know, contentious issues, things like wolves and bison and brucellosis and all these sorts of, you know, current topics that I think are really important to be educated about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you mentioned growing up in California.
Yeah.
I guess that when and how and why yeah. did you end up in Montana?
Yeah, well, that's a really long story. Well, the short version, I won't be too short, but I won't be too long because it is very long. After college, I had a music degree and not a whole lot of idea with what to do with it. So I did, and we can talk more about some of this stuff in detail later on, but yeah, I did an internship at the Smithsonian where I was an archivist for the Center for Folklife and Musical Heritage, or mm-hmm. Cultural Heritage, and it was mostly music. And that was a really cool gig. And then after that, I was very fortunate to go to Bhutan for about a month to participate in a field recording expedition for traditional music there. And then after that, I was kind of like, well, I don't really know what else I want to do with this music thing. So rather than, you know, doing what most people do and like trying harder, I decided to do something else because I wanted to see what that was like. I had a bunch of friends who were really into birds, and they were getting these cool jobs where they went to other cool places. I wasn't really ready to be like an archivist and settle down and like, you know, have a normal job, I guess. And I was able to do this, which is, you know, a privilege that I should admit to. But I ended up taking all these, like poorly paying, but super interesting field jobs. So I ended up moving around between California, Australia, Dominican Republic. I took jobs in the desert Southwest and New Hampshire, just like all over the
place. Are these with academic researchers or institutions, museums like the Smithsonian, or what? Who are you working for in doing these field trips?
Yeah, so good question. Some of it was academic, some of it was sort of like, well, one organization I worked for was Institute for Bird Populations, and they're more of a nonprofit. They partner with the Forest Service and the Park Service. So it was kind of all over the map, but it was always doing research, and it was always on birds because there's just lots of jobs because people with money like birds sometimes. So there's money for that kind of stuff, and they can actually hire field techs. Yeah, so that's only about half of the story. And then I ended up in, so I met my current, my now wife in Australia. She was leading the crew out there, and she was doing grad school in Ithaca, Cornell at the time, also in birdsong stuff. So I moved in with her, and then after she finished her program, it was like my turn to initiate the next move. So I got into grad school at UM in Missoula, and yeah, did my study over there.
Why did you choose UM?
Well, because Eric Green is there. He was my advisor.
Okay, tell me about what he does.
Yeah, so he's kind of all over the map. He does a lot of stuff, but the stuff that I was most interested in is this work on alarm calls. So birds and lots of animals give these very specific calls when they detect danger that alert other individuals in the area to that danger. And there's like, you know, different types of calls for different types of danger, or different species of predators, or different predator behaviors. So like a flying hawk will get a much different call than a perched hawk, and the response is totally different from like the, you know, the prey community. And we were talking about, you know, interspecies communication, or at least information transfer, which is kind of maybe not a super meaningful distinction if you're not in that academic world, that little slice of it. But yeah, so his work on alarm behavior and communication and bioacoustics, so animal sound stuff, that was what drew me to him. He was the only person, he was the first person that I knew of to be asking a lot of these questions, and one of the first people to really come up with some like very interesting, very detailed, and very like scientifically rigorous conclusions about what's going on with alarm calls. He was the guy that discovered that, well, him and his grad student discovered that chickadees, they give this call, chickadee-dee-dee, that gives them their name, and the longer the call with the more D's it has at the end, they can tag on like, you know, up to a dozen D's. So the more D's will indicate a higher threat predator or a higher threat situation.
Oh, that's almost grammar.
It is. I mean, it's pretty close. People talk about bird language, and I don't think that's, linguists don't like that.
But, yeah. Well, yeah. I wanted to dig in a little bit actually into this question. What for you are the differences between signaling and maybe communication, if that's another level, and then language? What are the differences? What do birds do? You know, where do they fit on this spectrum of increasing complexity of information you can transmit?
That's a great question. I don't think anybody really has a good answer for that, because I don't think we understand enough about what birds are actually doing. And I think everybody who studies bird communication, and probably any kind of animal communication, well, at least maybe not. I don't know. Maybe snails aren't doing quite as much as birds are, and maybe you can have like a full understanding of like snail communication. Maybe it's simpler, but at least with, you know, birds and mammals and probably fish, there's way more going on than we know. And we know that. We know that we don't have a full understanding. I don't think, I mean, based on our current understanding, so signaling, I would consider that to be like a necessary component of communication. So I think that's kind of part and parcel of being a communicating animal, which is all animals. The difference between animal communication and language, I'm not an expert in language. Like, I've never studied linguistics. But I think maybe what's lacking right now that would, you know, show that birds actually had language would be, well, there's probably a number of things. I think words, they have, you know, elements of meaningful sound that can be recombined in different
ways. Well, like this DDD of the chickadee is almost like a word that you can repeat to have an influence on the meaning. But I guess one thing, I'm not an expert in this area either, but when I think of communication, I think of two-way. And for example, there's a difference between maybe just a bird giving an alarm call, and then other birds can receive that, of course. But is the one giving the alarm maybe also listening for the response and responding differently? Like, is it possible to ask where or what and alter the call so that there's actually a back and forth there of sorts? Do you think that happens?
I don't know how much that happens in alarm calling specifically, but it certainly happens with birds. Birds sing, and one of the functions of song is to kind of negotiate territorial boundaries and situations, resources, things like that. So birds do this thing called countersinging, where one bird will sing and another bird will sing in response. And a lot of times birds will get locked into these countersinging like battles where, you know, one bird will sing, the other bird will sing, and just kind of small to large variations in the exact song that each of those birds sings can be really meaningful. So with some species, if you sing the exact same song as your neighbor, that's like a threat. And then if you want to escalate that threat, you start singing that same song over top of your neighbor, so you're like talking over them, kind of. So there's definitely like an exchange that's
happening.
Reminds
me of dueling banjos.
It's a little like dueling, or like a rap battle, maybe. It's something like that. Dueling banjos. But it's totally communication. And birds duet, too. So there's like definitely, you know, information being passed between two birds when they duet. There's chorusing, you know, in frogs and all sorts of information transfer. With alarm calls, I think it's more of a group thing. So, like I was describing, the chickadee dee dee dee, that's a mobbing call, which is a specific type of alarm call where the predator is either not flying or can't fly. So like a terrestrial predator or a perched hawk or owl.
Does mobbing mean that there are a lot of chickadees surrounding the predator then?
Exactly. So when somebody sees that hawk, say it's a chickadee, they'll give a mobbing call. And like the function of that call is it draws in all these other birds, not just chickadees.
It brings them up.
Uh-huh. And then they'll actually like, you know, sort of attack. they can, like with smaller owls, which are a higher threat, they'll get really, really riled up and sometimes like hit the owl in the back of the head, things like that. So they'll get pretty aggressive with these predators as long as they're not a threat. A perched owl, if it's been detected, doesn't have the element of surprise. It's not so much of a threat. They're certainly still dangerous, of course, but so these birds will get very, very bold, especially chickadees. They're nasty. And I think that the communication that's happening between chickadees at that point is a little less like what we would call language. I think it's more of like they're like a larger mob will last longer and get louder and have more birds, you know, drawn to it than a smaller mob. They've tested this with playback experiments just of like, you know, different numbers of birds mobbing, where they just play that sound, you know, two chickadees giving mobbing calls versus like five. And the response from the community is really different. So there is information shared there. I don't know that it's so much of a back and forth as much as it is just like a kind of swarming mass of information that lots of animals are picking up on. Mm-hmm. And then there's like a spatial component too, which is what I was trying to look at.
The title of your master's thesis is The Effects of Forest Gaps on Animal Communication Networks.
Right.
So that obviously gets into the spatial aspects of things, but maybe if you could tell us a little bit about the goals of that research, what were some of the special challenges or surprising results you found out of that?
Yeah, so the goals, I mean, I wanted to see, well, first of all, me and my advisor and like basically any like bird language enthusiast. There's lots of non-academic people who are interested in bird language. I don't know. I don't use that word. I did the scare quotes, I guess, but that's not pick up on the microphone. So people who are interested in understanding what birds are doing, especially around mobbing calls. I think there's this very strong hunch that birds use spatial information and that they also kind of pass calls along. So this is like the the premise of the research and also something that I was trying to show, which is not a great place to start if you're going to do a project, but I was too interested in this to not. So basically the idea that you know, I was trying to test, one of the ideas was that if, you know, a bird hears an alarm call at some distance away, it may not go all the way to the source of that call to like join in the mob or whatever behavior might be happening, but it might still give a call in response. And this is something that we, you know happens. Birds don't always join the mob, but they may be calling from some distance away.
So this is a secondary call by a bird that's not the one seeing the predator.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that kind of opens this hypothetical potential for birds hearing each other at, you know, further and further distances away and sort of passing this alarm information on. And this is something I've heard described a lot from a lot of different sources, but not, you know, this is just like observationally and never like tested. So that was one of my goals, was to kind of test this hypothesis of like waves of information moving through the forest. The other thing I wanted to investigate was whether, you know, if there's a big hole in the forest, like a clear cutter or just like a natural meadow or something, if that would influence this, you know, this wave, quote unquote, wave of information. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it was really difficult. We set up these big microphone arrays that were like, oh, I can't remember what the exact number was, but they were like 350 meters long and like 140, 200 meters wide or so. With, I think we had 15 microphones in each. So they're really big and they took a long time. We surveyed them out because you have to get really precise locations for these things to actually, you know, have them talk to each other in a meaningful way, basically, to get some spatial information from it. And we do playback experiments where we play, you know, some type of alarm call at one end of the array, and then at some distance away in the woods, we'd have people watching a feeder. And there were, you know, two feeders where we were observing birds, one with the playback speaker and one without. And we would just watch and record the responses. The goal was to try to like trace this kind of, you know, information hopscotch thing that we expected to be happening between successive birds at different distances away. It turns out that's really hard to do, because if they're not within the recording range of those microphones and it's also pretty loud, you might not hear it. And we almost never were able to like trace that spread of information, but we did get responses at the other end. And the interesting thing was that so I expected that having like forest gaps would be an impediment to the spread of this information, but in a lot of cases, especially with smaller gaps, we tested a couple of different sizes, and with the smaller and like even, you know, medium sized gaps, like 100 to about 200 meters,
is that a gap that's big enough that you need a bird in the middle to get the sound across, or would one bird on one side of the gap be heard on the other side?
Yeah, see, that's the sticking point. We definitely tested like up to, you know, greater than like the hearing range for these birds. And I didn't really expect that they would hear that well across these gaps, but it turns out they did. And so the response was actually higher across like the smaller gaps, which is surprising but interesting. Mm-hmm. and actually in retrospect kind of intuitive. But one of these things that, you know, you don't really know until you look. And then across a larger gap, like no response whatsoever. But through continuous forest, they did seem to respond. My sample size was really small, so there were like not enough experiments that I was able to complete to have like a really robust conclusion about this. But like observationally, and you know, if you look at like the data, they did tend to respond across even gaps of continuous tracts of continuous forest without gap. So it's evidence supporting that hypothesis, but it's not a conclusive, definitive answer like, you know, I was hoping to, and you never get in science anyway. But
well, the distances you're talking about, or at least the size of your microphone arrays, were like a few football fields. Communication, does it sometimes take place over a mile or as much as that, or what are the limits?
Well, we don't know. I thought 350 meters would be a limit. Like, I didn't think it would reach that far. Mm-hmm. I thought that we would discover the limit because I made my arrays so absurdly long, but it turns out that that's not the limit. So I don't know. And nobody's looked. That's the first study that's ever investigated like movement of information over distance. So At least distances that size. So yeah, I have no idea. Mm-hmm. Can't answer. I doubt it's miles, because at some point it doesn't. It's not relevant anymore.
The value
anymore,
is and, not there anymore.
Yeah, but I mean, I wouldn't have thought it was super valuable 350 meters away either. So,
do you have a sense? It sounds like you weren't able to completely disentangle this, but do you have a sense of like how many steps in the communication to cover that kind of distance, like quarter of a mile or so? Would that be three birds or?
Yeah.
How many?
Oh, that's a good question. I think in like the one experiment that we were able to trace it a little bit, it seemed like there were about three. So starting with the speaker bird, there were like, and then ending with the furthest bird away, there were two in between that called and that we thought were passing the information.
So altogether involving four birds.
Four birds there, to get like, I think that
might be an average kind of.
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it was N of one, right? Samples, that there was only one that we could do that for. So maybe it's typically more, maybe it's typically less, I don't know. But that was over like 300 meters. So that was a pretty far, that was a pretty long distance for what that's worth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, besides looking at bird sounds and recording those and having studied ethnomusicology, you're a musician yourself.
True, yeah.
And can you tell us a little bit about the kind of music you make? And, you know, maybe we'll maybe you could recommend one or two that we might play at the end of the episode.
Okay, sure, yeah. It's a hard question. You know, I should come up with a better answer for this, because the more people hear my music, the more they, or hear that I make music, no, they want me to describe it. It's almost entirely acoustic. I've been calling it experimental folk music, for lack of a better term. I try to make really like rich textures. I like drone a lot, so a lot of my songs are all like very, very slow. And a lot of the stuff that I think you've heard is totally lacking rhythm.
Why is that? What's attractive to you about a drone or relative lack of rhythmic structure?
Right. I think,
is it closer to nature?
I think that may be it. I not so much that it sounds like anything in nature specifically, but I think that it encourages the same type of listening that we were talking about earlier, like I'd like to encourage in people experiencing the natural world. So I think maybe this is just an underlying philosophy I have that I'm just realizing right now in this conversation, slowing down and like really paying attention. Deep listening, I guess, is a term people use sometimes when they're talking about difficult music, I guess, and how to get something out of it is really slowing down. So it's like, I wouldn't put my music on at a party ever, because no one would want to hear that. But if you, I mean, I feel like the ideal situation for listening to the music that I make and the music that a lot of my favorite artists make is like alone and able to focus on it, like a long drive or something like that.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I feel like trying to describe it, slow, textural, lots of drone, I like dissonance, and I like, also really like clean harmonies, but not a lot of thirds. That's a musical, that's a little bit technical, I guess, but most of the chords that we hear in Western music involve like a major third or a minor third. And I like to leave those out in harmony a lot, because I think it gives it kind of an ancient sound.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, so I think I haven't listened to much at all, but yeah. I think some of your work incorporates recordings in natural environments along with music that you're playing on some instrument.
Yeah, that's true. So yeah, I do a lot of field recording in my spare time, and I like to incorporate those into my music as well. I think a lot of people do that, and I like it best when field recordings are given the space to breathe. And so I try to do that as well. So I feel like when you use a field recording, that's like using an entire like finished track of music. It's got everything there. It's a full ambiance. And so I like to, when I use field recordings, I think it's really important to not overwhelm them with like my sounds, like my musical sounds. So I'll use field recordings to kind of give a bit of texture and a bit of like full silence, I guess, like rich emptiness. I don't know. That's abstract. but that's kind of how I think of it. Like a rich texture that's good enough on its own that can then lead into something that's musical and people will at least not feel like they're just listening to something out the window.
I'm wondering, just in your process, do you tend to maybe have an interesting recording you've done and think of accompanying that in some way with music? Or are you, do you have tunes in your head and you're noodling around and you're reminded of a recording, or you think you actually want to go out and get something that's appropriate to this musical idea you have?
I think all of the above. I mean, I'm working on stuff right now, and yeah, I definitely went out and got specific recordings of Bozeman Creek because I knew that that was what needed to go in a couple of spots. Mm-hmm. But generally, I mean, I've been recording for so long, I guess it's not actually that long. I've got a lot of recordings, I should say. I think it's sort of like there are all these like really special, like what I consider like the personal gems of my, I don't know, recorded library. And so those are always kind of in the back of my head somewhere. So it's like a stored idea. And then sometimes I'll be like working with a song and thinking like, oh, this would be a really good place for, you know, X field recording. So I think it's sort of, it's something that comes later in the process for me. I haven't really designed a song around a field recording yet. But yeah, I think it's usually something I'll add when something is needed that I don't want to be music, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Are you kind of always on, observationally? I mean, if you're walking around town, you're going to the grocery store, whatever, are you always hearing, and paying attention to things in your environment?
I try to be, yeah, I mean, anyone who's known me for any length of time will have seen me like whip out my whatever phone or whatever I have to record something on and like walk up to the vending machine and like stick it there for like 5 minutes or something to get the vending machine sound or whatever. So yeah, kind of. I think it's a little more difficult. I have a kid, a 1-year-old kid, and you know, she takes a lot more attention than I would need to spend on grocery shopping, you know. So it's a little different now, but yeah, I definitely like I'm always tuned in. And also like with birds, anyone who like spends a lot of time with birds has this like twitchy thing where like you're outside with them and you're talking and all of a sudden they're like looking somewhere else or like listening to something that's not you. And it's like, oh, where did that person go? And I definitely do that. I've tried to tone that down, since, you know, knowing people that aren't like that, it's kind of rude. So
have you gotten into recording your 1-year-old now?
Oh yeah. Yeah. She makes all kinds of weird sounds. We have I've got a lot of recordings of her. Yeah. Yeah. They've been incorporated. Actually, there's on the album that's on Bandcamp right now, there's a song that ends with her heartbeat when she was still in utero.
Do you have any favorite spots in the Bozeman area or maybe farther afield, places that you might go, you know, that are just favorites of yours or for a particular kind of experience?
Yeah. So I haven't been in Bozeman that long. We've only been here since August. So we haven't ventured too far afield, I guess. My favorite Bozeman spots are all around town. I mean, I find myself at the cemetery on top of Pete's Hill pretty frequently. I really like that spot. It's very quiet. And I've been seeing some cool stuff there this winter, cool birds. There was a three-toed woodpecker, which is like a little yellow cap. Mm-hmm. And they're, you know, in my experience, not easy to find. I think maybe they're a little more common in Bozeman than any place I've been before, but that was really cool. I really like that spot. That's great because it's like walking distance from my house. Yeah, probably nothing super surprising to anybody. I mean, Hyalite's great. It's like so close and so different. Yeah, it really feels like you're getting into subalpine up there, which is super cool. And then, I don't know, other places further afield. In Australia, we're in far north Queensland, so tropical northeastern Australia. And there was this big crater, and now I can't remember what the name of it was. It was a bit of a drive from the field house into the rainforest. It was at like Mount Hypipimi State Park or something like that, and there was this crater, which was huge. And I think it was like a sinkhole that had just like really developed, and then it was just these rock walls that were like straight up and down, filled with water at the bottom. and there's like a little boardwalk that you walk out to and you can look into it. And I just, yeah, I have this really great memory of just having this shotgun mic that I like stuck down into the crater, directional microphone. So it was like just getting what was in the crater. And there were these two frogs at the bottom, and they would give this call that was like, and then there was another one that was a little lower. So there was like this, it was immense echo, like the best reverb I'd ever heard in my life in like a natural setting. So just this repeated like kind of conversation between these two frogs, each saying its little like tick and then talk, tick, talk with this, I don't know. Yeah. Each one lasted like 3 seconds of echo or something after the end of these frogs. It was amazing.
Wow.
That's a cool spot.
Mm-hmm.
That was a cool spot.
That'd be fun to visit sometime.
Yeah.
So just to finish up, I wonder if there are any resources that you might recommend to people, either favorite books, websites to go for learning about natural history or some of the things we've been talking about.
Yeah.
About audio recording or music or
sure,
journaling,
yeah.
All of these topics, things that you go back to or that you recommend in your classes.
Totally. Yeah. So, for audio recordings, I really like Macaulay Library, and Zeno Canto is just Burrs, but they have a ton of really great recordings too. Super searchable. These are online databases. All of my like natural sound field recordings are archived with Macaulay Library. That's through Cornell. But yeah, Zeno Canto's got tons. And there's so many good resources for like insects, singing insects of North America. They've got tons of audio recordings and then lots of other cool information about bugs that make sound. Gosh, like iNaturalist is great. That's just like people's observations, and then there's a community of naturalists that will, you know, help you identify stuff. Mushroom Observer for mushrooms and fungi is great. It's kind of same story but more focused. Books like lots of field guides. I really like Mark Elbrock's tracking field guides. He does one. He's got one for mammals. It's really cool. One for birds. One for insect sign, which is
wow,
fascinating. The bird one too.
That's honestly a topic that never even occurred to me.
I know.
A topic.
Yeah, yeah. When I first saw that book, it was like, holy crap! Like I had never thought of doing this, but yeah, gotta buy that book. Yeah, and there's I don't know. I mean, so many books. There's a textbook, Animal Communication, that's actually really interesting and like full of cool case studies. That's by Jack Bradbury and Sandy Varenkamp, also out of Cornell. It's highly readable for a textbook.
So where can people hear some of your music if they're interested?
Sure. Yeah. So I have one album up on Bandcamp right now. And if you just go to bandcamp.com and type in Cedar, you'll find me. I'm the only Montana Cedar, and there's just one of me there. And then I think you can also just type in Cedar Aaron, CedarArarAn.bandcamp.com. And that has my music. I'm working on another album right now. That'll be up soon.
Well, thank you very much for a fascinating conversation, Cedar.
Yeah, absolutely.
Though the day does dissolve, there's a picture evolving too slow for our sight. And though the sky it does turn, the same figures recur in the west. Watching our constellations of leaves, and from any place there's a point out in space where the past is received. Thank you. we know day must end. We pretend, not so soon.
For the sun, we are left.